Radhika Jones, editor-in-chief of Vanity Fair. If you enjoy binge-watching the best TV shows and love hearing from the actors and showrunners who make them happen, then subscribe to Vanity Fair. Our Hollywood reporters take you behind the scenes of the year's most anticipated projects, the industry's biggest moves, and the hardest-fought awards races. From The Crown to The Real Housewives, we've got the inside scoop. As a special thank you to our still-watching audience, we're offering 15% off a yearly digital subscription to Vanity Fair. Visit vanityfair.com today and use promo code POD15. That's vanityfair.com, promo code POD15 for 15% off a yearly digital subscription to everything you want.
Is the world more peaceful since the revolution? It is a shame that your people suffered. But bounty hunting is a complicated profession.
Hello and welcome to the first sort of official episode of Still Watching The Mandalorian. I'm Vanity Fair senior writer Joanna Robinson.
And I'm Vanity Fair special correspondent Anthony Bresnikan.
Every week on this podcast, we are going to break down the latest episode of the Disney Plus series, The Mandalorian, starting this week with an episode titled Chapter One, the introduction of the Mandalorian and the whole universe that we will be playing in. There are no spoilers in this podcast. We will be talking about chapter one only. So don't worry.
There will be chapter one spoilers.
Yes. So you should be all caught up with chapter one before you listen. There are some rumors I've heard on the wind and I might allude to those, but nothing concrete and nothing too scary, I promise. We also have a couple really fun interviews this week, which we're really excited to bring to you. We've got, Anthony's chat with Jon Favreau, who is the series creator, showrunner, executive producer. Mm-hmm. So we will have some Jon and Anthony in here. And then Anthony and I both got to talk to absolute legend, Carl Weathers.
Carl Weathers.
So you will hear that at the end of the episode, our conversation with Carl Weathers. And so we are going to go through the episode beat by beat, sort of scene by scene, point out maybe some things you might have missed, point out some of our observations, just chat about it in general. If you have anything that you want us to talk about, something you observed, something you're excited about, you can always email us stillwatchingpod@gmail.com. I love reading listener emails out on air. So stillwatchingpod@gmail.com. Send us your questions, comments, or concerns, corrections. I think we got one little thing wrong. Last week. Yes. All right.
I
got one little thing wrong last week, but I agree with you. I was like, yes, yes. Ahsoka Tano is definitely a Twi'lek. And I stroked my chin and nodded my head. So I'm complicit.
It wasn't such a declaration, but just in passing, I mentioned that Ahsoka Tano was a Twi'lek. She is actually a Togruta alien. No points this round. Sorry.
But she does have the head tails, which was what we were talking about.
That's what threw me.
That was all part of our preview episode, which we recorded last week, which you can listen to if you are completely lost in the world of Mandalorian. We did a lot of stage setting, but we will do a little more in this episode as well.
That was our prequel era. That was the
prequel. Yes, yes. A lot of extra CGI in that podcast. before we get to sort of our rundown of the episode, we want to start with the biggest thing of the episode. So seriously, if you haven't watched chapter one yet,
mm-hmm. Warning.
Get out of here. Here it comes.
Don't complain later. We're going to talk about it. We're going to talk.
Get out of here.
We're going to talk about the being. That's how the actors spoke about this revelation when we spoke to them a couple weeks ago, right, Joanna? Do you remember?
Yeah, we were trying to get them to talk about what happens at the end of this episode a little bit. We knew, full disclosure, we knew there was some small thing.
We knew that there was the thing he discovered was some young
small thing,
babyish thing.
Yeah. We didn't know anything else. And so we were trying to get the actors to talk about it, and we were like, you're allowed to talk to us, which they were. And they, even then, without permission, they wouldn't say a gender. They wouldn't say anything. They just would say the being, like they could feel the, crosshairs of the sights of Star Wars, like on their forehead. Like, don't talk about what it is, but it is a little green thing.
A little, I wrote in my recap of the episode, a little, I thought he looked like a shamrock shake come to life. Just this cute little delicious nubbin of a, I guess what we're calling a baby Yoda.
I mean, I have some options. I'm going to offer up some options to you throughout this episode of what we might call this thing.
Okay. But I think, the being is kind of cool because, that's much better than Baby Yoda, because we don't know whether this is like a clone or, you know, right. I hate to call the species a Yoda. You know what I mean?
It's not, right.
Yeah.
Yeah. So let's clarify a few things. So what's a big deal about this, in and above the fact that there is like an adorable little Muppety thing now in the show, is that Yoda is this figure that George Lucas has historically been very secretive about. We don't know the name of his species. We don't know the name of his home planet. Dagobah is not his home planet. We don't know the name of any of that. And George Lucas has intentionally never talked about it. And not only that, he has, you know, as the world of Star Wars has expanded beyond George Lucas's core story, storytelling, he has issued a mandate, I believe, that these figures, these creatures are not allowed to be used.
Yeah. So he made them kind of a one of a kind creature, you know, and with the exception of Yaddle, which I think was a misstep.
Yeah. Yaddle looks like not great in the prequel series. Yaddle is on the, I believe it's a lady, on the Jedi Council, in Phantom Menace, I believe it is. Anyway, not a great looking, creature.
Looks like younger Yoda in a toupee.
Looks like a gremlin, honestly.
Looks like Yoda with the Irishman de-aging process applied to him.
But the species is not called Yoda. Like, that's like saying all Wookiees are called Chewbacca. They're not, right? And so we don't know what to call this thing. But one idea we had when you and I knew that there was a small being in the series, we had some theories. Mm-hmm. And one of them was that whatever it might be a clone. We were like, is it a Palpatine clone? Is it Rey? Is it like we had all sorts of theories what it might be. I'll confess a small Yoda-like thing, never occurred to me.
But we did hear rumors of Yoda was in the show, right?
Right.
You remember hearing that? Like that there was buzz.
Oh, I do.
There was buzz about Yoda. So are we allowed, can we do like what our guess was going in? Like, or what each of our guesses was going in?
Yeah, I thought it was Rey. We thought maybe this was going to be like a Rise of Skywalker prequel, and we were going to find out how Rey got to Jakku.
That she was protected by the Mandalorian, and the Mandalorian's the one that dropped her off after basically protecting her for long enough. And I thought when I heard the Yoda, you know, as you said, I like what you said, like you went out and you heard this news on the wind. Like, that's journalism, man. You walk out your front door and just it's like Cinderella. The birds and the animals are like, hey, did you hear Yoda's in The Mandalorian? And, I thought, okay, he's going to get Rey. And then at some point, like moment of doubt, all hope is lost. Like Yoda is going to appear to him. Yes, because Yoda's Rey's guardian angel or something, you know? I don't know that I was fully prepared for a little gumdrop baby Yoda.
Oh, a little gumdrop. So, but we had ideas that this, whatever this is, might be a clone, because listen, this thing is 50 years old.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, Yoda was 900 when he met Luke. So, you know, that lines up to me. 50 years old is still a baby. But that puts the creation of this being, right back when Anakin was born, like mm-hmm. almost exactly when Anakin was born. And right around that time, they started doing a lot of work with cloning. So we were like, is this a Yoda clone? ? Do you have any like emotions around that, Anthony?
Well,
do you want it to be Yoda clone?
I mean, there was cloning cloning was in like technically like the Clone War era, right? Where they started making this army.
Yeah, later.
But it was Anakin. The whole question is like, isn't the question like, did Palpatine cause his creation, or was this the Force that caused his like virgin birth? Which goes back to a very George Lucas-y thing of like ancient mythology and the gods being, you know, not born of man and woman, but really like springing from the mind. In a way that I guess makes them more pure or, you know, unique among other beings. So, like, I guess it could be cloning, but it also could be, the implication could be that that Yoda just is another expression of the Force, right?
Right. And so, and if you want to talk about balance, we referenced this viral Freddie Prinze Jr. sort of rant thing that went around on our preview episode last week. And I want to reference it again because the driving idea in that little speech that he gave about Star Wars and the whole idea of Star Wars, which he got from Dave Filoni, which Dave Filoni got from George Lucas, is this idea of balance. You guys know this. Balance of the Force. That's a whole thing. Mm-hmm. So is a question is like, was an Anakin-type creature created 50 years ago and a new Yoda-ish creature created 50 years ago, and that's our light and dark balance.
Interesting theory. I like that one.
Question mark. We don't know. We don't know any of this. But what's fun is that the Mandalorian has been given permission to play in the world of Yoda and a Yoda-looking creature. You mentioned mythology and gods and sort of biblical storytelling. So one option we have for this creature is Green Moses. I'm just going to float that to you. You can chew on it, decide if you like it.
Green Moses playing on a double bill with with Dolomite and Shaft. Like, that just sounds like a 1970s blaxploitation character.
Oh, so that's a no. Okay, so the reason why this might be the time for a Yoda thing to appear in Star Wars has to do with Dave Filoni's connection to George Lucas. I think, like, we don't know this, and maybe we'll get like firmer reporting on this as this goes on. But like, my theory is, if Dave Filoni, who directed this episode and is an executive producer on the series, if he is George Lucas's Padawan, his the Sorcerer's Apprentice, the guy who trained under George Lucas, I feel like if George would let anyone play in the Yoda pool, it would be Dave Filoni, right?
Yeah, I think, if I think he would definitely trust Filoni with the sort of mythic pseudo-religious elements of this, because that's a big deal to Filoni. You know, what the deeper meaning of Star Wars as a philosophy is something that Filoni is really into. So, you know, we joke calling him Green Moses, but like, Yoda really does serve an angelic purpose in the Star Wars canon. You know, he's, again, there aren't other versions of him. There aren't other, you know, he's not part of a society. He's alone. He's very much the wise old man who lives atop the mountain, in this case, a swamp world. And I think Filoni has played with him before in Rebels and in the Clone Wars.
Right, in the animated things.
And in Rebels, you know, he made Yoda appear as a vision once and always got providing guidance to, like, young Ezra, aspiring would-be Jedi, if Jedi were still being trained. Actually, what was kind of funny about that is he made him look like the little toy Yoda, from years of Kenner past. You know, you remember that thing had like a little like a tan cloak, but it also had this inexplicable orange snake around its neck. You know,
I had that toy.
Yeah, I think everybody had that toy. And I can't remember now whether he ended up getting the snake or not, because I think that might have cost too much money and broken their budget. But he made the Yoda look like the toy. And that's what I kept thinking of when I saw a little. Are we calling him Green Moses? Are we going with
that? No. You can call him Shamrock Shake. You can call him whatever you want.
I guess, yeah. Green, like I said, Green Moses sounds like a greensploitation movie, like crime fighting badass in the galaxy. But I think that he looks like a cute little toy. He looks like something that a you know, that I when I saw it, I thought, oh, every kid is going to want one, even if it's like a marshmallow on a stick with like sort of gritty.
Oh, absolutely.
Gritty, yeah, sugar on top. But like it's, I think Dave really does get the heart of Yoda, the philosophy of Yoda. And, surely George would have, if he had misgivings about this, would have at least felt comfortable, that Dave had a hand in it.
What's interesting, Star Wars has always been I learned this from, my friends over at the Blank Check podcast. The word is toyetic, right? Star Wars has always been a toyetic property, which means, you know, they make their stories sometimes with toys in mind, or toys naturally spring out of the stories that they tell. You just have to look at how many people had like stuffed porgs, or how many people have like little R2-D2 things, cassette players, whatever it might be. But yeah, that baby green thing, that little Shamrock Shake is a very toyetic character for sure. And we should mention that this seems to be a puppet character, which, you know, is very important to me. I'm not a huge fan of CG Yoda. Puppet Yoda did return in The Last Jedi. We saw they used the original molds for puppet Yoda, when he was force ghosting with Luke in The Last Jedi. And, I'm a big fan of puppet Yoda. So this is a little puppet. And that makes me happy.
Yeah.
So
yeah, it had a very tactile look about it.
Yeah. Good. All right, so and I'm gonna gender this thing he, because the Mandalorian does at one point. He calls it he, so I'm gonna say he until I learn otherwise. That's all what right. I've decided to do. Let us go down to your conversation with Jon Favreau, because Jon talks about a lot about Dave Filoni and a lot about Dave's connection to George and why that gave them license to do a lot of the things they did in this series.
Well, I was talking to Kathy Kennedy and presenting to her this, you know, I came in to kind of pitch in the, you know, out of the blue to her, you know, I just came in with an idea for when the Disney streaming service was announced. And I had been talking to Kathy about the idea of collaborating for many years, mm-hmm. you know, but I was a, you know, it wasn't until the streaming service that I saw a way to tell a story in the way that I wanted to, at the scale that I wanted to. And it seemed this new medium was going to be a really good fit for it. And so I came in with a pretty well thought through idea of the time frame, the world, and the characters that I wanted to present. And as I laid them out to her and she realized that it was about Mandalorians, she immediately thought of Dave, who had been talking to her as somebody who was inside Lucasfilm, who was talking to her about projects that were related to Mandalorians as well. And she asked me if I knew him, and I said, do I know him? I know him for 10 years. It felt like a really good partnership, because I was bringing in the background in live action filmmaking and in storytelling from my perspective of, you know, the mythic form and the monomyth and the hero's journey that I had learned, you know, and was inspired to learn through watching the work of George. And he had been there working hand in hand with George for all this time. And so we were very good. And he also had a background in animation, mm-hmm. which really informs the first part of the workflow of the way that I've been working with technology since The Jungle Book.
Yeah.
'Cause I've been really trying to emulate the front end of a animated production in the way that we move into post-production. So there was a very good complementary set of skills that we both shared. And, you know, I don't want to I don't want people to think that he's just a director and a guy that I hired to be part of my ensemble of filmmakers. Mm-hmm. He's somebody who's truly a partner.
It strikes me that The Mandalorian, I know you're drawing a lot from like The Man with No Name, the Clint Eastwood, yeah. Sergio Leone Westerns, like, this is a loner character. And
yeah,
I what I like about Dave's work on Rebels and the Clone Wars is he really gets at the heart of a character. Sometimes it's like a sidekick partnership, like Obi-Wan and Anakin. And sometimes it's like the mentor, apprentice thing with Ahsoka and Anakin and other times like the family dynamic in Rebels. What did he bring, or what did you draw out of each other when it came to telling the story of The Mandalorian?
I think it started with our love of Star Wars mm-hmm. and our sense that we really wanted to honor everything that had come before, and that we weren't using Star Wars as a springboard to tell a story that we could not have told otherwise. We wanted to tell a story that fit into the world that George created.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that Star Wars exists as something that if you have enough people around who understand it and care about it, and you discuss ideas or thoughts or storylines or characters, you could get a pretty good sense of whether or not it fits into that world.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think together we were able to help understand the way that this story could fit into that world, and to also reach back to what influenced George Lucas in the first place when he set out to tell this space opera.
Mm-hmm.
And he was heavily influenced by Kurosawa, by samurai films, and mm-hmm. by that cross-pollination between samurai and Western, of classic Westerns, and also World War II action films
sure.
as well. And so we were really exploring the iconography of what had influenced George in the first place. And together we did a deep dive into a lot of films that were around long before Star Wars to see how that might influence the way that we present that through the lens of the Star Wars universe. And I know that there's an appreciation that George has for the way that Dave and I working together.
Your storytelling always, I think if there's a theme amid all the different types of films you've made and stories you've told, is there's always a strong theme of friendship. Even when there are characters who are kind of going it alone, they eventually amass people around them. And I mean, going back to Swingers, you know what I mean? Like, that's such a great friendship story.
I never thought of it that way, but thanks for thinking about it that much. I think you're probably onto something.
And what I remember about being a kid, especially with Star Wars toys, is not playing by myself in the backyard, but having my best friend Joey come over and yes. making up stories yes. together. Is that how it felt with Dave
yes.
doing The Mandalorian?
Yes. Yeah, you did. You said it.
Mm-hmm.
It was Orson Welles who said that you're playing with making a movie is like playing with a big train set.
Mm-hmm.
And there's no bigger train set than Star Wars. Cataloging everything and maintain, you know, keeping cataloging all the assets and costumes and aliens, that we have this we have access to all this stuff that these great creative people had made before us.
Yeah.
And so sometimes we're building our own stuff, sometimes we're repurposing stuff that was there before. We even go through drawings for different ideas that had been that hadn't been used on previous productions. And we look at these things. We're like dealing with Doug Chang, who's works for mm-hmm. Lucasfilm and is one of our
yeah, no doubt.
You know, who works on works on the design aspect of the show. And we're looking at all this artwork, and then all the way back to the Macquarie stuff, cracking open the old Macquarie books and saying, "Hey, this design was never used. Let's have this character come into the world." I mean, that's like a dream come true if you grew up like we did, watching Star Wars
yeah.
and playing with those toys, with those little 4-inch figures,
mm-hmm.
those little posable action figures. And now we're getting to play with, you know, you're having real astromechs rolling around the set. You're having, you know, approving new blaster designs and looking at people walking around stormtrooper armor. It's it's a bit of a thrill. And for somebody like me, who I've made a lot of movies, and so when you get to work on something that really excites you and feels like something new and something different, you really appreciate that and make the most of it. And also, because it's not a movie, it doesn't feel like you make it, it's done, and people look at it.
Yeah.
And if they like it, maybe you get to make another one later. This one, we're going to be filming the second season while when the first season's coming online, and people are going to be seeing it.
So living it for a while.
We're going to get to, you know... So we get to be in a conversation with the audience.
Yeah.
We get to go back and forth with them. And that's really, you know, and not over the course of many years, literally over, you know, immediately you're back and forth
and
making the stories.
It's nice.
That's exciting.
It's nice to have somebody like Dave then by your side, like just to share it with you. You know, you get to look at each other, I'm sure, when you see some of the things you're creating, and you know, get to geek out a little in addition to being a professional. That must add to the energy of it all, right?
I think it, I like to think, I know that like with chefs, when they love what they're cooking, you can taste it in the food. And I'm hoping that the passion that we have and the excitement that we have and the joy that the whole team has in putting this thing together is something that you can feel when you watch it. Because it's certainly on the set, and it's certainly something that we're, you know, it's a tremendous amount of work, but we love it.
Yeah.
And we jump to, you know, there's just not enough time in the day sometimes, but we, you know, I definitely go home invigorated and exhilarated, and then we talk over the weekends about what else we could do.
Yeah.
So it really feels like we're throwing a big party and planning a big party.
And
so that's very fun. And I would say what's interesting about Dave, to get back to him, is that the way that he even came to be working at Lucasfilm really feels like he won a contest, you know, that he won a Star Wars fan contest, and he got to be, you know, he got to be allowed to work on the ranch and allowed to work on Star Wars.
He got the golden ticket. He's Charlie, right? He's Charlie.
He got the golden ticket. He really did. And he got to learn from his idol, you know, and so now he has that knowledge. He studied like anything else. When you have a teacher that you studied under for that long, you have a certain aspect of that passed down and it becomes part of you. And so that's, you know, as much as it's great to work with Dave, there's also a sense that he really understands and is a direct connection to the very genesis of all of this and the amount of time that he spent with George and how much deep his understanding. Not that we never depart from, you know, from what he would have done on other projects, but we at least we understand that there's a consistency and we understand where we are connected to it and where we depart from it.
I'm Alex Schwartz.
I'm Nomi Fry.
I'm Vincent Cunningham, and this is Critics at Large, a New Yorker podcast for the culturally curious.
Each week, we're going to talk about a big idea that's showing up across the cultural landscape, and we'll trace it through all the mediums we love: books, movies, television, music, art.
And I always want to talk about celebrity gossip, too.
Of course.
What are you guys excited to cover in the next few months?
There's a new translation of the Iliad that's coming out, Emily Wilson. Really excited to see whether I can read the Iliad again, whether I'm that literate. I mean, the jury is out.
I can't wait to hear Adam Driver go again in an Italian accent in Michael Mann's Ferrari.
He can't stop.
I mean, and bless him. I can't wait.
Molto bene.
Molto bene.
We hope you'll join us for new episodes each Thursday. Follow Critics at Large today, wherever you get podcasts.
You really don't want to miss this.
Don't.
Don't miss this.
Don't miss it.
See you soon.
So, all right. So that is the Yoda of it all. We are going to talk a little bit more about like foundlings, which is an interesting theme in this episode a little later on. But let's go back to the beginning and start at the very beginning. We get a new, to my eyes, a new logo at the beginning, right? This like
the Star Wars lights, thing.
Yeah. Lights on a on helmets.
Yeah.
Thing. Do you think this is the Star Wars TV logo? Does that seem right?
It was pretty slick. I mean, I guess they're probably just conscious of the significance of that fanfare, the 20th Century Fox fanfare at the beginning of the original trilogy and prequels, and probably want to just give you a little bit of a almost like an epigram, you know, just a little intro, get you in. Let you know, a little send up a little signet, another word that's important in the show,
yes.
to symbolize that this is Star Wars. So yeah, I thought it was kind of cool looking.
I agree. And then we get this. So we start with this. I'm calling it a cold open, even though it's not technically cold open, but it takes place on a snow planet. So why not, right?
Very good.
So this is the Mandalorian getting his first bounty that we see. And it is the first set piece is this sort of cantina, moment, which is so Western you could die. And we talked about Western influences on this, but like basically I think he enters the room to pan flutes. I'm pretty sure that's on the soundtrack. Yeah. And you've got a bartender. The bartender slides him a drink. You know, there's a lot of, you know,
There's a lot of, we don't like your kind around here. What are you looking at? Like, he's got a helmet on. I don't know if he's looking at anything. You know, he's got no peripheral vision on this thing. but yeah, he walks in and the flutes, I mean, that to me, the instant I saw and heard that, I thought of, Ennio Morricone and Fistful of Dollars and, we talked about that in our preview episode, but it's. I mean, look, there's a long tradition of snow westerns too, like everything from The Hateful Eight to Mr. McCabe and Mrs. Miller. So So you know, snow westerns are a thing, and that's definitely where we are here. A little frontier. Looks like almost like a sea. There's like some sort of, it's almost like an Arctic town where they're doing some sort of sea trawling. The bad guys, the Toffs, are called trawlers. And one of them is played by Tate Fletcher, who is a former MMA fighter who, like, just turns up as a thug in everything. He's, like, one of the white supremacists from the finale of Breaking Bad. He was brutally executed after a battle with John Wick in the original movie. You know, he turns up here giving the Mandalorian a hard time for spilling his drink.
Then we get... My favorite line of the episode comes really early.
What was it?
And it's Amanda going, I could bring you in warm or I could bring you in cold.
Look at you breaking out the impressions. That's very good.
Thank you.
A very nice Pedro Pascal by way of Clint Eastwood.
My Pedro Clint impression. which is basically a, we can do this the hard way or we can do this the easy way. So it's a very Dirty Harry sort of like, are you feeling lucky punk sort of line, right? Mm-hmm. So, he's here to collect a bounty on a mithril, played by Horatio Sanz. Mm-hmm. This blue guy.
Fishy, bulbous kind of guy. Like, he just looks like he should be in a tank of water.
Right. I think at one point he's like, my gills or something.
Yeah. So, and he's like, I'm not going to make it. I love he's like playing off his sympathies like a guy in the back of a squad car. Like, I'm not going to make it back for Life Day, I guess. See my family.
Right. So Life Day, for those who don't know, is this is a Christmas special reference, right?
Yeah, that was, you know, they don't have Christmas in the galaxy because they don't have, they don't have Judeo-Christian.
They just have Green Moses, Christ.
They don't have Christ, but they have Green Moses. But it's, you know, it's you got to have some kind of holiday to celebrate, right? So you honor the maker on Life Day. And that's when Chewie, I guess the premise of the original, the much maligned Star Wars holiday special, they have to get back to Kashyyyk to celebrate Life Day with Chewie's family. What was that kid's name? The one who's in all the gifts now?
Oh, I don't know. I've never seen a holiday special.
Lumpy. I think I can't remember whether it's his little bit, like his tween Chewbacca is, look, we're not calling the species Chewbacca. Like the little tween Wookiee is called Lumpy, I think. Or is that, I can't remember. Is that Chewie's wife?
I mean, of all the references I expected to have, of all the Star Wars properties I expected to like find a reference in this show, the holiday special was not one of them. So, you know, good, like extra marks for trying.
They really
with
good.
This Life Day reference.
They really got that. They really slipped that under the door before it slammed shut. Yeah. It's, that was fun.
Brian Posehn gets a short lived cameo, right? As this land speeder driver. We find out that the Mandalorian is mildly prejudiced towards droids, right? He doesn't like droids.
Everybody has a problem with droids.
Everyone?
Well, like, you know, in the original Star Wars, we don't serve your kind in here. Like, you know, like droids, whatever it is about droids, man, people are like, GTFO.
They're taking our jobs. They're taking Brian Posehn's job.
That's what it is. You're right. They presaged the blue collar revolt against automation. Well done, George.
The Mandalorian ship is, I think the model is a Razor Crest, right? And so, I don't know, just write that down. I don't know if you
Razor Crest. I think that's the actual name of the ship, like Millennium.
Oh, is it? Yeah. Okay. Okay. Razor Crest, another toyetic moment, right? Like that's the Mando ship is Razor's Crest.
So. Yeah. I mean, a lot of kids grew up having the Slave One, the, Boba Fett ship and it came with a little like frozen in carbonite Han Solo. And this one has like six fugitives that come sliding out of its nether regions out of its hall to that sounded weirder than it should have, but like
the family show.
It's sort of like, yeah, it's sort of like a, instead of just one frozen body, now you've got like four or five bad guys that he's dropping off.
We see this poor bounty get frozen in carbonite, and then we're on to the next location, which looks like a, you know, you mentioned in the preview episode that every planet has a, you know, ecosystem, one ecosystem, right? I'm calling this one the Foggy Rock Planet, is what I've decided to call this one, where we meet Greef Karga. And you spotted something very special in the background here that even my second time through, I couldn't see with my own eyes. What did you spot?
You did see it though, right? Did you end up seeing it? It's like an eight, the 18 minute, 31 second mark. Like that's,
I didn't see it. I saw your screen cap in your piece on Vanity Fair about Easter eggs in this episode. If you haven't read Anthony's piece yet, you should, to see with your own eyes. What do we see, Anthony, at 18 minutes and 31 seconds?
Well, you see a kind of like underworld, little, not criminal, but like underground lair where there are a lot of Mandalorians. There are little Mandalorian kids running around with their own unique little helmets. There are, you know, a couple of Mandalorians look like they're playing a game off to one side. And there's one who walks along the ledge beside our hero, the Mandalorian. And, he's got the coloring of Boba Fett, sort of, gray, blue mixed with green and, a couple of little signatures of yellow and red on him. And the thing that, I mean, although like, you might say like, well, they all look the same, right? With the helmet and the gear and all that. But like this coloring is very specifically Boba Fett. And it's funny because I did the screenshot and, it's very much like a Georges Seurat painting. Like it's all like grainy and pointillism right now, because it is in the background. It's meant to be indistinct. It's not like, you remember in the special edition of Star Wars when they add Jabba back to the mix and Han Solo kind of steps over Jabba and then like has his exchange with Jabba and Jabba walks away. And then Boba Fett walks into camera, looks at the camera, turns back and walks off camera, which is very much a, ladies and gentlemen, Boba Fett for you. this isn't like that. This is, you could watch this a bunch of times and not notice it because he is very grainy in the background. And even the screenshot is kind of like the, I think I just said Seurat, but it's also very Bigfoot, that image of Bigfoot in the woods. Sure. Like could be, could not be, kind of hard to say. Very indistinct.
I will say I was very skeptical when I just read, cause I read your piece before I saw the images. And when I read that you had seen it, I was like, sure, sure. And then I saw your little Sunday in the park with Boba Fett. And I was like, I think it might be. So, you know, allegedly Boba Fett went into the Sarlacc, pit, but like, we think, anyway.
Now
the Mandalorian is not Boba Fett, right?
He's not Boba Fett, but, and the thing that really sells it is not just the coloring of the armor, but like that he has the dent in the helmet on the upper left side that's like, I just meant for that to be another Mandalorian. Like, you don't put that particular marking on the character unless you intend for people to go, is it? And I think Filoni and Jon Favreau are just like laughing seeing people go, oh, is that Boba Fett? Cause they get to go, I don't know. Is it? And
is
they
it?
Don't have to answer it. But there is a little bit of provenance here. In Aftermath, the novel written by Chuck Wendig that's, you know, takes place after the events of Return of the Jedi, but before the Battle of Jakku, where they really did kind of mop up the remnants of the Empire, he has these little interstitial chapters. You know, Han and Chewie show up, they're running a new mission, and at one point, he describes, I think it's like a junk seller on Tatooine, who has armor. Mandalorian armor that has been recovered that looks very similar to Boba Fett's. So it's not necessarily Boba Fett, but it could be somebody who just picked up his armor and is trying to be, you know, part of the Mandalorian community.
There we go. So, you can make your own, draw your own conclusions, basically. But someone who is definitely here is Greef Karga. Mm-hmm. Who is sort of running bounties. He is who will pay, The Mandalorian, and he is also someone who will give the Mandalorian new jobs. I think two very important things we learn in this exchange between Greef Karga and the Mandalorian. One is that the Mandalorian would rather be paid half in calamari flan, which is a monetary unit. Akbar, right, is the calamari, right? Calamari flan.
What's the name of the currency? Flan?
I think it's flan. That's what my closed captioning said.
I mean, like, flan. Oh, really? Like the Mexican dessert?
Like a custard. Yes.
it did have a squishy sound to it handed it over. Yeah. And I was like, huh, interesting. Like that the money is, it's been in the sea. You know, it's squishy.
Right. But he would rather take half of his payment in calamari flan than the full payment in imperial credits. And that tells us something about how the Mandalorian feels about the Empire without saying this is how the Mandalorian feels about the Empire, right? That's a conclusion that I drew from that decision.
Okay. That's not the conclusion I drew.
Ooh, what did you draw?
I thought of it as something like, after the fall of the Confederacy in the Civil War, what would Confederate money have been worth? You know, like, does it have any value whatsoever? I just thought he was rejecting it because he didn't want, that it was worthless. You know what I mean? That it was actually, Karga said it still spends, right?
Yeah, he says it still spends. So
I like your interpretation. That didn't occur to me, but I'm going to go your way because I like it better.
Oh, lovely.
But my initial reaction was just, oh, it must not be worth anything. Now I'm blanking. Isn't there a movie where they go looking for treasure and they end up finding the treasure, but it's like Confederate money? So they're like, great.
Oh, I don't know. But that sounds right to me. Email us stillwatchingpod@gmail.com if you know which Western Anthony is talking about.
If you know what I'm talking about, yeah.
All right. And then the other thing that we learn, that I think is important is about Greef Karga, which is, or more about the state of the universe, where the Mandalorian is talking about, like, the kind of jobs and what they pay and what kind of work he can get right now. And Greef Karga says they don't mind if things get sloppy, they being, like, whoever is collecting the bounty or whatever. And, so that to me establishes the lawlessness of this world. Right? The code of the bounty hunter, the value of the bounty hunter is degraded in this lawless world where things are allowed to get sloppy, right?
Exactly. And he's a character who lives on the edge of society, but, he's sort of he's a bad guy. He lives among outlaws and yet he's commissioning vigilantes to go after outlaws, and he's doing it in a very judicious way because he wants everyone who is in his, you know, quote unquote guild to have money to be paid for. So he's kind of this patron who's looking after people. But he's, you know, the way Carl talked about him with us, he also thought of him as like a bad guy who would do a lot to survive. And what I really like about the Greef Karga character is he's trying to be good in a bad place, in a bad time, in a time of desperation and starvation and collapse. And you have these characters like the Mandalorian who are existing in that atmosphere who now have the responsibility to care for something that's pure, that's innocent, that's sweet and young and needs help. And so you have the corrupt, you know, these people who've become corrupt in order to survive, taking care of an innocent.
Yeah. And I think that, that theme of code, your own personal code, your moral code, what is your code in a lawless world? I think that's going to be a really important theme, and that applies to Greef Karga and definitely to the Mandalorian. You know, and then we get more information, sort of what the Mandalorian thinks of Imperial forces, I believe, in this next scene with Werner Herzog, right? Because, Werner Herzog plays the client, the unnamed client. He's being guarded by a bunch of, guys in, you know, trooper armor. He's wearing, an Imperial sort of seal, right? Mm-hmm. And so you have talked before about how this is a guy who's holding on to Imperial ideology after the fall of the Empire.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then he also, there's a doctor character who pops out and almost gets blasted. And, what's the actor's name?
Obed Abtahi.
Oh, that's right.
And yeah.
You know, and that leads me to give credence to the clone theory, because this is a guy who...
A doctor, right?
You know, he seems like a doctor, but he doesn't seem like a very he's got a little bit of Dr. Nick from The Simpsons about him. Like, just like, he seems a little dirty, surrounded by these scruffy, like these stormtroopers who've clearly seen some hard times and, they're really beaten up and muddy and bloody. And you got this doctor there who seems a little shifty, you know, and he doesn't look like an OBGYN, so, and he's 50 years too late for that. So I think, he must be there to study this thing, right? He seems a little more like a scientist than an MD. Was that your read?
And I think his desire to have the thing alive makes me, believe, that he thinks of it as a specimen to be examined. And he's very distressed at this idea that, like, the client would be okay with it coming back dead, you know? So.
Yep.
Then we have to talk about this method of payment here, and this, sort of bleeds us into our next scene. So I want to talk about, I believe it's pronounced Beskar, right? Which is this Mandalorian armor, iron that they use for their armor. And then he gets this one little piece of it, but a whole, Camp Tono of Beskar is waiting for him at the end of this job. And he takes it to this armorer character. And, we are going to now pause to talk about Mandalorians and their armor and what it all means. Anthony, do you have I have some thoughts. Let me know what thoughts you have here.
About what the significance of Mandalorian armor is?
Yes.
So, he stops and visits in that underground lair, this blacksmith who's voiced or performed by Emily Swallow, female Mandalorian. She takes this little iPhone sized cube of, of Beskar and, you know, it's also imprinted with the Imperial seal, this sprocket like seal, which, I mean, reminds me of like Nazi gold or, I think the movie I was thinking of was Sahara with Matthew McConaughey, where they go in search
Not a Western.
Yeah, where they go, I mean, but kind of like where they go in search of like, I think it's Confederate gold, but, you know, you have this, this thing that's precious to them, but it's marked by, I think, what they would consider evil. And she goes, oh, it says something like, I haven't seen this since this was from the Great Purge. And then we see flashbacks of a young family running amid battle and explosions and blaster fire. And I don't know if the young boy is supposed to be the Mandalorian or whether this was something the Mandalorian witnessed. I'm kind of leaning toward the former. And because I think that it informs his decision to be a protector, is that maybe at some point he was protected as a boy from this purge. So she melts down this cube of Beskar, which, doesn't have quite the same properties, but I think it's sacred to the Mandalorians. Like, it's sacred in the way that vibranium is sacred to the people of Wakanda in the Marvel Cinematic Universe. Like, it's a part of their heritage and their culture in addition to being this useful item. So she makes this little piece of,
I just say really quickly that I definitely wrote vibranium in my notes, but I also wrote Valyrian steel just to make sure that we're hitting all the,
and Game of Thrones.
All the properties
the
here.
Geek trifecta. You got Marvel, Game of Thrones, and Star Wars. And she melts it down and makes a piece of shoulder armor for him. And I kind of wonder, is he going to be showing up to her throughout, like building.
Oh, I hope.
Building his armor, you know, like as he goes, like becoming. She says something like, has your signet been revealed? And he goes, not yet. And she says, soon. I don't know what that means. What do you think it means?
I have no, like, I looked, you know, deep into the wikis to try to find something about this. A Mandalorian signet. There are signets, like signet rings in the universe and blah, blah, but what it seemed like to me when she was saying signet, is almost like a sigil. It's or almost like your house in Harry Potter, or almost like your Patronus in Harry Potter. It's like something that is, you know, something that she can mark the armor with, some sort of symbol that is going to be revealed to him, maybe spiritually in some way that has to do with what his destiny is as a Mandalorian. But it seems new. It seems new to the mythology. So that was the implication to me of that phrase, but we don't know.
Yeah, I think you're right. I think it's whatever it is, Patronus, that's a good explanation. I think it's evidence that like there is something, that he has to prove, that he has to earn.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
Reveal, you know.
What kind of man will you be?
His, as my son who loves Ninjago would say, his true potential. What is his true potential? Look at that. We're bringing in all sorts of stuff from all sorts of quadrants.
I love it. We don't want to bog listeners down with too much like Mandalorian lore. We recommended some Clone Wars episodes, some Rebels episodes that you might want to watch, but I did do some like research into some Mandalorian stuff that I think might be helpful to chat about at least briefly. There, I will just say, you know, to vastly simplify the history of the Mandalorian people, like Mandalore is a planet. The Mandalorian people are not, they're humanoid, but they're not necessarily like a singular type of person. And so the thing that unifies them as a culture is their armor. When they put on the armor, they all look the same. And that's something culturally that is important to them. Mm-hmm. They call their armor Beskar Gum, which means iron skin. Beskar and then Gum, iron skin. So this is their skin. This is their identity. If you want to talk about another geek property, his dark materials, there's these like polar bears that have this armor that is like, the armor is so important to them culturally, spiritually, in a way that, you know, is hard to overemphasize. And the other thing about the Mandalorian history, right, is that they were very warlike, people. They were conquerors. They expanded out into the outer rim of the galaxy. And then there was a pushback on that. There was a rising, and this is covered in the Clone Wars and Rebels, of a, like a peaceful Mandalore. We don't have to be Spartans, right? We can be, we can be Athens. We can be something else. And then that was sort of like crushed. And so Mandalore has this sort of split identity of their like martial identity and then their, you know, their thoughtful, spiritual, artistic identity.
Yeah. And Spartans, yeah, I love that you just said Spartans because that really looks like the inspiration for the helmet too. Like they had very similar designs. So, or at least in terms of the eye, the way the eyes are cut out and the sort of, vertical slit down the middle. Good comparison.
So I wonder if we're going to see this character who seems to, it's not just, he takes the Beskar, he gets his pauldron, his like shoulder piece, but then she also, this armor also talks about how the excess, either the Beskar or the Calamari Flan or whatever, is going to help the other foundlings. So he's a man on a mission to earn money for the greater good, right? We feel like he's a man with a code. Even though we saw, you know,
it's like he's sending some of the money back to the folks back home.
Right. Exactly. So to watch him maybe struggle with those two parts of him, the violence and the peace and like what part is he going to pursue? What is he made for? I think is going to be sort of a central question, of this show.
Can I add one thing?
We talked about the young
Clint Eastwood from the Dollars trilogy, the Sergio Leone spaghetti westerns. It's a man with no name going through, dealing out rough justice. But also this thing you just mentioned about the Mandalorian handing out some of his reward to this sort of helpless underground, desperate Mandalorian culture of what seem to be almost refugees. That reminds me a lot of Clint Eastwood from Unforgiven, you know, this old guy, not that the Mandalorian is old, but like who doesn't want to do it anymore. You know, he's not like that. He's been cured of drink and wickedness and he killed everything that walked or crawled at one point. Doesn't want to do it. Just wants to look after his son and daughter, but he realizes he has to do it in order to look after them. So there's a weariness to the Mandalorian that he's doing this for a good cause. He's not just, you know, enriching himself and then, say, partying or drinking the spoils, that there's a greater good he's working toward, even if he sometimes has to do it in a brutal fashion.
Love it. We'll talk a little bit more about the Mandalorian code, which I researched, which I'm really excited to talk about. But we do want to move on from this. I will just read one quote really quickly from a non-canon Star Wars novel. So, like, don't get mad at me. This is non-canon, but I think it's applicable. It goes, there are two reasons why we have to wear armor. This is a Mandalorian talking. There are two reasons why we have to wear armor. One is so that we don't get killed too easily. The other is that so that we all look Mandalorian, however different we may be from our brothers and sisters. And so just that idea of the Mandalorian armor as, especially for a refugee, race like the Mandalorians, their identity is so tied up in it. So it's so important. And that brings us back to this like purge thing that you were mentioning. We don't know exactly what this is. There is something called the Mandalorian purge, but that took place in a different time frame. So we don't quite yet know what this is, but I agree with you. I think the young boy we see in this flashback is definitely supposed to be the Mandalorian. It's a very, Jor-El puts Kal-El in the ship and sends him off, right? You get the point of view shot of him in the little, like, vehicle and the door closing and his parents seemingly sending him away. So very, like, Superman, once again, talk about Moses, vibe. And then I just, based on that, I want to talk to you really briefly about Star Wars and Lost Children. We've got, Finn, right? Was like taken from his family. Rey is a lost child. Anakin is taken from his family.
Luke
and Leia to a certain degree. Jyn Erso, Han and Kira. Like this is a theme that Star Wars is very preoccupied with. And so to see both the Mandalorian and this little, Shamrock Shake, I'm sticking with Shamrock Shake.
All right.
As these like foundling critters, And what it means to look out for those creatures in the galaxy, it just seems such a core part of the Star Wars storytelling.
It really is, and I think you can look at a trope from a lot of Disney animation and fairy tales. Fairy tales in general is that you often have the lost parent, you know, the orphaned character who goes off on his or her own and has to survive. And I think there's a very simple reason for that, and that's that any parent is going to look after their kid. They're going to die for their kid. And so if you have storytelling that's aimed at young people, especially at like Star Wars, it can be aimed at little kids, you know, middle schoolers, teenagers, and everybody above, you've got to have a story where the hero goes off on his or her own. And you can't have that if you have a protective parent. You've got to separate them from that protection. So I think it's sort of like why people would say, like, well, why is George Lucas? He's got this preoccupation with cutting off hands. Well, if you got to cut something off, that's pretty much it, you know? And I think it's the same thing. So if you're going to cut something off of a person to put them in a desperate situation, especially a young person, you take away their guardian. You take away Uncle Owen and Aunt Beru. You take away mom and dad, and suddenly that person has to fend for themselves.
And you give them these other guardians like an Obi-Wan or something like that, but, or a Qui-Gon, but like, yeah, when you're cut off from that, protective shell, you then have to make these, harder choices yourself oftentimes about what kind of person you will be. You have to help shape yourself, right?
Well said.
And also this, you know, George Lucas is a huge student of Joseph Campbell and like hero mythology and stuff like that. So cutting off your hand, that's a big part of that, but also the chosen one narrative, which is something that he's preoccupied with. And often those chosen ones, like a Moses, are, you know, sent off, a Moses, a Superman, a Harry Potter, whatever it is, are sent off by themselves into the world. And that's just part of the storytelling. So, that's true, seems to be true of our Mandalorian character and seems to be true of this little green guy. So that brings us to our last stop, on our trip, which is I'm calling it the Arizona Mesa planet. it's a desert planet, but not like a, you know, it's not Tatooine. It's got a lot of cliffs and stuff like that. So,
it's very Arizona, very Utah.
Yes, yes, yes. So we've got comedy with Blurgs. We've got, Nick Nolte's here. Taika Waititi's here, in the form of this Ugnaught character and this droid character. What do you make of this last stop, for the Mandalorian?
I mean, yeah, like very traditional Western Monument Valley kind of setting. He hooks up with Kuil, I guess is how we pronounce his name, the little Ugnaught character that Nulty is voicing, and who looks remarkably like Nick Nulty. It's really just, like, kind of unsettling in a okay, cool way. And, you know, what's interesting is this, Ugnaught tells him, I love the way the Ugnaught speaks, right? Like, he'll say something, then he's like, I have spoken. Like, it's very much like liking your own post on Facebook.
Self retweet.
Yes. Yeah. Uh-huh, yeah. Uh-huh. Which I'm not above. Like, if I tweet out a story, you know, that I did in the morning, I'll retweet it in the afternoon, and I just want to add a little cool, I have spoken. But, you know, he says, like, what are you? You're a Mandalorian. You don't know how to ride a blurg? Like, what's your problem? Like, it's so, which makes me think that there's a part of the Mandalorian who's still discovering his heritage, if that is indeed his heritage, or if it's one he's adopting, you know?
Yeah.
I think, I thought that was kind of cool. And then that he chooses to help him, that he senses something in our hero that is heroic and not just another desperado who's making his way through dangerous terrain toward this what's obviously like a little base. You've got some bad dudes there, and like remarkable Wild Bunch reference at the end with the galactic version of a Gatling gun.
I wrote Gatling gun in my notes too. Yeah. Yes,
you know,
yes,
famous. Famous Wild Bunch sequence with Sam Peckinpah where they just unload with a Gatling gun on a whole little hacienda full of local toughs, and like just totally reminded me of that.
Gatling gun for me, since I've never seen the Wild Bunch, but for me, that last setup looked like the end of Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid, right? Because you've got Butch sort of like up against this pillar in the sort of exact same position that the Mandalorian finds himself in at one point. So, you know, all kinds of Western references, but I think those are two very valid ones that happen right there. We get a little bit more light droid bigotry, and to me, that you know, to me, when the Mandalorian's on the cliff and he sees IG-11. And he goes like, basically to me, it read as like battle droids or bounty droids. I hate those guys.
Yeah.
Indiana Jones reference. Yeah. And he, you know, so he reluctantly teams up with this Taika Waititi voiced, bounty droid, against these, I believe they're Nyctos. That's what my caption said, which is aren't there Star Wars aliens that are named like Klaatus and Nyctos, which is
a day the Earth stood still reference. Yeah.
A very dorky George Lucas reference. You know, cleans them out and then, kills the droid. I don't know that this is the end of the droids are very easily rebuilt. So maybe this is the end of Taika Waititi's droid character. Maybe it's not. I don't know. But, shoots the droid, takes the cannoli.
I like that. The cannoli is good. What, when we're going with Green Moses, Shamrock Shake, I like the cannoli. That's the best one. Okay. Leave the droid, take the cannoli. That's amazing, Joanna. That's great.
So, and there we go. And then we get closing credits, and we don't know what he's going to do, but it seems like in ensuring that this little green nugget, this little cannoli, this Green Moses, this Shamrock Shake survives, it seems like he's decided to protect it rather than turn it over. We don't know yet. He could decide to do that.
He's not going to let this droid waste that baby.
No. No. But is he going to trade that baby for a bunch of, Beskar? I don't know.
Beskar. But yeah, but.
Beskar. Thank you. Yeah. that's going to be my only mistake I ever make with all these.
I didn't mean to Mandalorian splain to you.
Oh, wow. Yeah. but that's, you know, that's the question. I'm leaning towards no. But, you know, we'll see, what happens to that baby.
Well, this is classic noir too. Okay. So to figure out what this thing is, he kind of has to go back to the source, right? Okay. Does he know what a Yoda is? Does he know who Yoda is? Like, what's the Mandalorian's understanding of this creature? And I think he almost has to go back now and figure out what they wanted it for in order to decide whether he wants to turn it over. But I think it's clear they did not want to, that they're not running some sort of a galactic daycare, you know.
No.
And one of our little ones has gone missing, and we really need to recover him. There's clearly something nefarious here, so he's got to figure out what this is and why people want it. And I think more than one group wants it, so he's been commissioned, but the IG-11 droid has been given a separate commission, and that commission.
And why were the Nyctos there in the first place?
And what were the Nyctos doing there?
Yeah.
And so, you know, I think he's got some questions he wants to have answered, and that's going to be part of caring for this creature.
When we found out there was a little thing in this show, even though we didn't know what kind of little thing it was, the property that I was thought of immediately was Willow, which is about a group of adventurers protecting a baby on a journey. So the other thing that I think of, and this is way less classy than Willow, currently streaming on Disney Plus, which is The Fate of the Furious. I don't know if you saw that, the latest Fast and Furious movie. There's this great fight sequence with Jason Statham and a baby. And I was like, if we get like some great, good, like Mandalorian fighting while also protecting a little, Shamrock Shake, I will be overjoyed. So, you know, that's what's coming up on The Mandalorian in theory. We don't know yet. We haven't seen any other episodes, but
that's interesting. Like I can get behind that where he's, you know, he's got the baby protected and he's got to shoot his way out of somewhere. Like, you know, the comparison I made in my recap was to, Lone Wolf and Cub or The Road to Perdition, you know, where you've got a tough or Leon, the professional, you know, where you've got like a tough customer who's got this innocent to protect. And, I just think that's really powerful storytelling. And I'd love to see that action sequence. That'd be kind of cool. I'll bet you we get it.
I mean, all theoretical, but that's what we're hoping for. So that is chapter one of The Mandalorian. We will be back so quickly. We'll be back on Friday, but first, before we sign off, we want to bring to you our conversation with Carl Weathers. This was, at the Mandalorian Junket a couple weeks ago, Anthony and I are sharing a mic. So if you hear any echoiness or whatever, that's what's going on there. But Carl's beautiful voice will come through crystal clear for you, in this interview.
I think we need to start with this man's name, Greef Karga.
Greef Karga, what a name.
I mean, it sounds like grief, right?
It sounds scary. Greef Karga. He's either very, very sad and carrying a lot of baggage, or he's just a weird dude. Greef Karga. Yeah.
What strikes me about him is this is a man who, he is living on the fringe of society, on the outside the law, but he's a bit like a patron, right? He's got his community of bounty hunters, and he looks to take care of them. He's trying to make sure everybody is fed and everybody's taken care of. He doesn't strike me as a bad guy, is he?
Well, your interpretation of him is a lot more generous than mine was.
Tell us about your interpretation.
When I first read him, first of all, when you use a word like patron, it just, for me, it just brings up a whole other kind of grandness, you know? There's something about Greef Karga that reminded me a bit, as I read him anyway, reminded me a bit of John Huston. There's something about him that's just a little larger than life and something that you can't quite trust, you know. There's something in that I really like. Very theatrical, and that was the whole point. I just kind of wove in a little of it. Like when we're in the cantina and the Mandalorian comes in and I'm just telling them, he's asking me and I say, none of them could do it. Nobody but you, Mando. you know. And so there was a little bit of Huston's that's always fascinated me, you know, from as far back as I can remember. But of course the movies was Treasure of Sierra Madre, of course, because he, as a director, but also as an actor, was just so powerful. And then Chinatown, which he didn't direct, but he acted in it, you know?
So menacing.
Yeah,
that.
I mean,
yeah.
Oh, Lord, at the end of it when she shot, you know?
Most people never live long enough to realize that under the right circumstances, they're capable of anything.
Doing anything, exactly. I mean, that's a rich character, man, you know? And there was just something about him that even if you were tall next to him, he still towered over you. Because there was something about him that was commanding. So, to your point about Greef Karga, there was some of that that I wanted to utilize in there and still not do a caricature, right? The name, though, does conjure up so many different things, I think, for so many different people. And for me, it's just another great moniker. You know, it's like Apollo Creed or Dylan or Chubbs Peterson. I mean, you know, Greef Karga, either you'll remember that or you won't. But most people, I think, will remember it.
Yeah,
exactly.
Yeah. So there's this big reveal at the end of the first episode that is this big, you know, closely held secret. What do you feel like that reveal, that moment, adds to the Mandalorian series as a whole?
The Mandalorian is, I think, in some ways like every other character in the Mandalorian. There is something about him that's very selfish and self-centered, but there's also something about him that's really altruistic and human. You know, there's a humanity to him. And you might be on a mission to do something where it's just going to get paid for it, and you're happy to get paid for it and do your job and go back and do what you do. And then there's something that all of a sudden you kind of find a, I don't know if it'd be compassion or what it is, but for this creature, and you kind of fall for him, you know, and it's, oh, damn it, you know, of all the, what is it, all the joints and the, you know,
all the gin joints.
Yeah,
the world.
Yeah, you know,
you had to
walk into this one. Yeah, you know, you had to walk into this one, you know. So it's the, I think that is one of those qualities about heroes, in quotes, that we love. We find their humanity, you know, or by the same token, is one of the old great tropes, and you see it movie after movie, but it always works, where your hero is really wounded badly. And what does he or she do? They pull out something with a makeshift needle and they sew themselves up. I mean, come on, man. You know how much it hurts just to have the wound. Now you're going to sew yourself up? Those tropes just work. They work over and over and over. So if you have a gun for hire, and the gun for hire is supposed to go out and gun down something, but guess what it does? It winds up falling in love with it in its own way. You fall in love with that character.
One of my favorite things about the Star Wars universe has always been these people who operate in the middle. There's like the good guys and the bad guys, and then you've got the rogues and the bounty hunters and everyone in the middle. And this feels like a show that's about the middle, about the moral middle ground. Is that something that you thought about in making this?
These people straddle a line, if you will, you know. There's a lot about them that's really admirable. And then there's that side of them that's truly selfish, or it seems to be leaning toward the devil, you know. And what you find out, though, they themselves wind up being tested. And the question is, which, you know, when they're tested, which direction are they going to lean to and lean into? And we are fortunate, I think, because of how smart Favreau and Filoni are and how much they know about this universe and how much they know about really writing and creating, that they drew characters and put those characters in situations where the characters really had choices to make. And the characters seem to keep making the choices that we want our heroes to make, you know, regardless of where they may start off. We wind up falling in love with them because their moral compass points them in the quote-unquote right direction. You know, now, will they maintain that? That's a whole other thing. We'll see.
The pendulum swings back
and forth. The pendulum does, exactly.
What do we learn about Greef Karga's history? Obviously, there's a big story going forward with him, but there was just this amazing galactic civil war that took place. And this story, The Mandalorian, feels very much like a Western. So many Westerns were set after the Civil Wars. Old soldiers who went roaming west to find their fortunes. How does the Western element fit into Greef Karga? And what has he done? What was his life like during the events we saw in the original trilogy?
That is a brilliant question.
We only ask brilliant questions on this podcast.
But part of the reason it's a brilliant question is because I didn't ask it. I didn't care. I didn't want to know. I wanted this character, from what I read on the page, to give me ideas about how to take the coloring book, open it up, try to stay within the lines, but to use colors that maybe someone else wouldn't utilize. So he is as vivid or as lacking in any kind of vivid color as I could manage to put on screen, along with the, you know, in collaboration with everybody else that was doing what they were doing. And if I had to guess, he was living in some pretty dark times. He was doing some, maybe some pretty dark stuff, you know. And as it comes out, you know, when people are under stress, certainly under the stress of war probably, or any kind of horrific stuff that's going on, they do whatever is necessary to survive.
Do you think he's haunted by that? Is he somebody who's seeking redemption, or is he kind of, is he amoral?
See, no, he's definitely not amoral. There is something in, if I answer those questions so specifically, then it's harder to play the ambiguity of this person. You know, we all may or may not have in our backgrounds different things that we're proud of, or that we really have thought of about that experience and what that experience was like and where it led to, and if somebody was hurt or not hurt. Sometimes just getting through it and getting on the other side of it is enough. Going back and rethinking it now is reliving it. So for Grief Karga, for me, and actually in some ways for all of our characters, unless in story, you're reminded of it. You know, if someone says, hey, you're from so-and-so, aren't you? Yeah, I was there when all that stuff happened. What happened to you in there? Now you're reminded of it. Now you got to relive it. Even if you don't answer the question, you have to relive it. Nobody's asked Grief Karga that question yet. And I want to stay away from it because I don't want Grief to tip off anything about where he comes from or what happened or what he did or didn't do. I want you now to question who he is really, you know, because if I don't give you any insight into background, you can't really make a guess. I want you to be wondering rather than guessing, you know, is he a good guy? Is he a bad guy? What's he doing? What's he doing? How is he manipulating that? Well, no, the way it turned out, he wasn't. But wait a minute now. Now he's doing this. You know, that is far more interesting to me.
You talk about wanting to discover the character on the page. Was there a line or a choice or a moment that you saw on the page that you say, okay, I really get who this guy is? It's John Huston or whoever.
There wasn't a particular line, but that sequence in the cantina of dealing with both Werner's character and with the Mandalorian's character said so much about him. What I was working to convey without a lot of vivid kind of directing the audience to something, I wanted to convey his relationship with Werner's character and then to see the difference in his relationship with the Mandalorian's character. Grief Karga is not as commanding with Werner as he is with the Mandalorian. So it sort of suggests something about the power of Werner's character.
So he's scared of him a little bit.
Yes. Yes, you know, you've got to be cautious with this guy, you know, without saying it, but you play your cards maybe a little closer to the vest. Now, with somebody like the Mandalorian, there's largesse. There's, you know, telling him how much you like him and you're the best guy in the world. And yes, you are my friend. You know, I trust you. Them, forget them. They're nobody. It's you. And then
that charisma.
Yeah, you know, so how do you show different colors with these different characters, which reveals in a way the relationship that you have to them?
Let's talk about another character, but a real life one. So you have this scene with Werner Herzog, who's he's a larger than life character, and you are too. So so what's it like? What was that? What was it like working with
him? I referred, and this is true, I referred to him the entire time on the set as Maestro, because I really think the guy is brilliant. And I mean, having watched enough of his movies, and you know, we talked a lot when he was on set, and I asked him questions, of course, and we talked about it, a lot about his relationship with Klaus Kinski, and you know, making movies together, and he revealed an awful lot about himself in talking about Klaus, you know, because let's face it, they'd worked together and had a lot of problems, and then Werner goes back again, but he not only wants to deal with the same guy, but he wants to deal with him in a situation that's going to be problematic in and of itself. Yeah. You know,
hauling that boat over the
mountain. Oh man, the fights they had, and
they had a violent relationship.
Yes,
it was not just
it was a love-hate relationship. There's no question in my mind. But Werner clearly saw the genius in Klaus that would work for his films. So he was willing to go there. So, you know, we talked about that, and he turned me on to a book which I really liked. It's called the Peregrine. And it's a weird book in its own way, because it's about a man in the UK who went out day after day after day after day after day, and he documents the days watching peregrines and watching them hunt and watching them move around. Nobody else, just this man reporting about the peregrines and what he saw and the prey that the peregrine would go after. And I knew nothing about this, but it was this fascinating book. Now, why is that book on a list that Maestro reads? That's an interesting one. So distilling that for me, I still haven't, but he turned me on to what I consider to be a fascinating book, because something about the observation, being able to watch something and focus on something and commit yourself for months at a time to go out and to do this. Rain, snow, shine, didn't matter. This guy was out there.
Sounds like you had a lot of fun playing Star Wars.
I did.
Thank you, Carl Weathers.
Thank you. Pleasure talking to you both.
All right, so that is it for us. Like I said, we'll be back on Friday with another episode, an interview with series star Pedro Pascal. So we got a lot of goodies for you this season. We're so excited.
We do, and forgive us if we seem a little punchy Everybody yesterday was trying to gauge when is The Mandalorian going to actually drop, and we'd heard like 3 a.m. Pacific time. So, Joanne, I think you were in bed early, right? You went to bed early.
Oh, I went to bed at like 7:30. I took basically a nap. And then my friend texted me at like right after midnight, and she was like, "It's up." And I was like, "Oh, then I'm up."
Yeah.
And I haven't slept really since.
Came back. We had a little Vanity Fair event here in LA last night, NBC. Yeah. So I was, you know, I got back like around midnight, and like, you know, people like, Jermaine Lucier of IO9 is like tweeting about how he's seen it. And I'm like, wait, what? I gotta go see this thing. So my wife is exhausted. She goes to bed. I stay up late watching it, trying to, you know, prepare my recap. But it's been a weird, like, all nighter in a way, right? I haven't been one of those since, can't remember when. So,
I mean, for me, it's bringing back some Game of Thrones feelings, but I think future episodes will land in a more sane fashion for us.
For a civilized era of Star Wars release schedule.
Right. Versus this disarray.
But that's what I love about getting to talk to you. I couldn't wait to do this because, we're so used to Star Wars as a communal experience, right? I mean, there's their series, like the Rebels and the Clone Wars, but even those have kind of a massive community surrounding them. So there's an instant conversation that happens, before and after each episode. And this is the first time with live action where, I don't know, I'm watching it by myself, right? And I'm like, I can't wait to hear what people have to say. I'm so happy to hear your theories and talk about it with you, but I hopefully our little conversation here will start that for other people too, as you go to work or go to school or watch the episode and talk about it. It's rare to be isolated. That's a new experience with watching Star Wars, but we want to bring people together, and make sure you email us your theories. Would you want to give that address again, so folks can shoot us anything they want us to talk about in the next installment?
I'm dying to. Stillwatchingpod@gmail.com. Please do send us your comments, questions, and corrections. We will read them out on air. You're going to want to catch up on everything that Anthony's been ranting about over on VF.com about The Mandalorian. He's got a bunch of great pieces up there for you guys to check out, including sort of like an Easter egg-y breakdown, including his capture of Bigfoot Boba Fett from this episode over on that piece. You're going to want to go check that out. Anthony, where can people tweet at you?
I am at Breznican, BREZNICAN.
I'm at Jarothis, and we will be back on Friday. See you then.
We've all been there before. You're planning a dinner party or having family over or even just cooking for yourself when all of a sudden it starts to feel overwhelming.
I live in a very small one-bedroom apartment with a very small kitchen.
I can't figure out what to serve besides water soup at this point.
I'm Chris Morocco, food director of Bon Appetit and Epicurious, and this is Dinner SOS, a new podcast from Bon Appetit. Maybe it's a last-minute party with no menu inspiration, a kitchen with no space, a toddler who will only eat buttered pasta. Name your dinner emergency. We're here to help. Here's how the show works. On each episode, we'll take a call from a home cook facing a real dinner emergency. Then, I'll work with one of our editors or someone from our amazing test kitchen to try and solve it. Because cooking for the people you love should inspire joy without a side of stress. Make sure you're following Dinner SOS wherever you're listening now.
From PRX.